Stories and content in Weird Darkness can be disturbing for some listeners and is intended for mature audiences only. Parental discretion is strongly advised.
War itself is a monster. However, across the centuries, there have been reports by soldiers of actual monsters in the theater of war. Some experienced fighters even claim that they have been reduced to primal panic and dread when faced with creatures that, in their mind, should not exist. If the stories are true, soldiers deployed on the battlefield may just have one more fear than simply their human enemy. I'm Darren Marlar, and this is Weird Darkness. Welcome, Weirdos! I'm Darren Marlar, and this is Weird Darkness. Here you'll find stories of the paranormal, supernatural, legends, lore, mysterious, macabre, unsolved, and unexplained. If you're new to the podcast, while listening, be sure to check out the website, WeirdDarkness.com. There you'll find the Weirdos Facebook group, my social media links, help for depression and anxiety, the Weird Darkness store, my personal blog, past episodes and show notes, and a whole lot more. It's all at WeirdDarkness.com. This is a Dark Archives episode, so it may or may not have fictional tales mixed in with the true stories, but you can find links to the stories or the authors in the show notes. Whether you're already a Weirdo family member or just now giving Weird Darkness a try, I hope you enjoy this episode. Now bolt your doors, lock your windows, turn off your lights, and come with me into the Weird Darkness. A relatively recent report of a wartime monster sighting comes from an anonymous U.S. Army Special Forces squad member who was tracking a Taliban person of interest in the mountains of Afghanistan. The squad's objective at the time was to observe a village for several days, in the hopes of witnessing suspicious activity or persons, which was hoped would inform and lead to a successful raid. The team comprised six men at the base, with two others whose job it was to observe the village at closer quarters. Over the course of a few days, suspicious activity was indeed witnessed by the squad, just not the sort they were expecting. Almost immediately, the team experienced technical problems. They had trouble maintaining radio contact due to static. Believing the magnetic content of the rocks to be the issue, the eyewitnesses described leaving the squad's base with some of the other men to reposition the SATCOM in an attempt to get a better signal. It was around dusk at the time. As they neared the SATCOM, one of the soldiers spotted a man in a white robe running through the rocks outside the village. Lacking reliable communication and worried about the mission being compromised, the men packed up their equipment and got ready to move. They were all on high alert as they trekked back to their outpost. Covering their tracks as they moved through the darkness, the witness stresses the carefulness with which they retreated. Regardless, every so often he claims he would catch a fleeting glimpse of something white moving in the distance. After a short while, he reported what he had seen to the others. An officer said he had seen the same thing. They were being followed. The sense of urgency and panic increased. They were a small unit, completely exposed, without a means of communication. Not only that, the witness reports that everything felt strange. The air felt heavy and sort of sweet. The silence hummed loudly. Now enveloped in the darkness of night, the team put on their night vision goggles. With the world cast in a perfect green haze, they scouted their surroundings. The men could see nothing and no one moving behind them. However, the danger of the night was far from concluded. What the witness describes as having happened next is chilling. Hallucinations happen, but what happened was beyond comprehension. First, we heard a sound like a huge airplane taking off, a loud, low buzz that slowly increased in pitch. We had to yell over comms to hear each other. Everywhere I looked, I kept seeing what looked like glowing eyes staring back at me. But once I would enter my focus on where I saw them, they would disappear. We were panicked. Everyone was holding their rifles at the high, ready. We were expecting some kind of ambush attack. Then it all just stopped. Everything got dark. The only thing I could hear was my breath and the blood pumping in my head. We stopped, dug into the side of the mountain, and performed SLLS – stop, look, listen, smell – for about 10 minutes. Nothing. Not even bugs. The air and the land were silent. The team was thoroughly spooked and overcome with fatigue and eager to get back to camp. However, they were very aware that something waited in the darkness for them – something which very possibly had intentions to harm them. They moved quickly through the scrub until they were met by the sight of a man dressed in light-colored robes. The man was slowly making his way towards them. According to the witness, the way that he moved was unnatural. He seemed to pass through any and all obstacles in his way, as though they were made of air. He seemed to melt over and around the rocks. Through the nods, night vision goggles, his eyes glowed. I scoped up on him and saw that he was looking directly at me. It was pitch black. There's no way he could have seen us from that distance without any kind of night optics. Suddenly, he stopped. He picked up one of his limbs and held it in the air, almost like he was waving at me. Then the arm melted back into his form like it wasn't an arm at all, but some kind of extendable proboscis that was meant to look like an arm from a distance. I was about to ask the guys if they could see him when he suddenly disappeared. After he disappeared, the team, shaken and weary beyond words, were able to finally make their way back to the base. In the distance, they saw lights flickering near the village. They all but forgot about both this and the strange otherworldly man until a few days later. According to the witness, on that very night, the village they had been observing was raided. However, it was not the raid they had been working to inform. Apparently, the team had moved into the village, found it completely abandoned. They also found several men in the area where I'd seen the lights that night. The corpses had been ripped to shreds, and based on the sheer amount of blood, the general consensus was that there were more men that were killed there than just the bodies that were found. It went in the official records as a successful raid with several enemies, KIAs. Unofficially, no one has any idea what killed them. All I know is, whatever it was, it chose those men and not us. Whatever the men saw that night and whatever happened to the village remains unknown. The Lombards were a powerful Germanic tribe that ruled much of Italy from the 6th to the 8th century AD. Paul the Deacon, a scribe of the Lombards, tells of a strange story in their history. In their early days, the Lombards were confronted by an overwhelming tribal army, whose numbers greatly surpassed theirs. Their passage was barred. However, the leader of the Lombards thought of a plan. He spread a rumor that amongst his allies were a pack of savage, dog-headed man-beasts that waged unyielding warfare, drank human blood, and cannibalized themselves if they could not reach their enemy. The opposing army, not wanting to confront such an enemy, let the Lombards pass unmolested. With our modern sensibilities, most of us would look back upon these tribal peoples as being foolish for believing such a seemingly obvious lie. Yet at the time, and for much of human history, the existence of a race of dog-headed men was almost seen as a matter of fact. Various ancient Greek writers, including the father of history, Herodotus, wrote of dog-headed men living in the mountains of India and Ethiopia. These canine men, also known as cynocephali, have been described as hunting for a living and communicating by barking with one another. The Greek physician and historian Tisias had this to say of the cynocephali. They speak no language, but bark like dogs, and in this manner make themselves understood by each other. Their teeth are larger than those of dogs, their nails like those of these animals, but longer and rounder. They cannot be defeated in war." St. Augustine suggested that these dog-headed men descended from Adam. Other saints, including St. Andrew and St. Bartholomew, have described such creatures as well, whose hound-like appearance disappears after baptism. For several centuries, theologians debated whether such dog-headed men, assuming they were real, had a soul and thus needed the Gospels taught to them. In the legend of King Arthur, it was told that he defeated a great army of dogmen on the hills of Edinburgh. Several medieval explorers have also claimed to have witnessed these dogmen. Writing in his travels, Marco Polo described encountering them on the Andaman Islands. "They have heads like dogs," he said, "and teeth and eyes likewise. In fact, in the face, they are all just like big, mastiff dogs. They have a quantity of spices, but they are a most cruel generation, and eat everybody that they can catch, if not of their own race." Arguably most peculiar of all is the legend relating to the patron saint of travelers, Saint Christopher. There are many different origin stories relating to Saint Christopher. However, one story places his origins at a battle between the Romans and the savage North African tribe called the Marmorite, fought about 300 AD. This tribe was renowned for their ferociousness in battle, their cannibalistic tendencies, and, most of all, their heads being those of dogs. During the battle, which the Romans ultimately won, a giant beast of man was captured. He had a dog's head, and he was named Reprobus. Whilst the legend takes many forms from there, all agree that the warrior Reprobus converted to Christianity and took the name Christopher. After being a soldier of Christ for some time, he was martyred in Syria and was eventually sanctified. According to the medieval Irish Passion of Saint Christopher, this Christopher was one of the Dogheads, a race that had the heads of dogs and ate human flesh. While this story is undoubtedly odd, the saint's canine head was such a well-known attribute that it inspired religious iconography for centuries. Stories of fearsome cynocephaly can also be found in Eastern sources, with the Buddhist missionary Wai Sheng describing an entire island off the east coast of China being filled with a race of dog-headed men. Tales of dog-headed men, it seems then, were commonplace. Everywhere around the world, people believed that there was indeed a savage race of men with the heads of dogs, bent on murder and cannibalism. It is possible that many of these tales had their roots in ignorance and prejudice. However, when the enemies of the Lombards heard the rumor of the cynocephaly that day, there was much for them to fear. The Battle of Chickamauga, which was fought on the 19th and 20th of December 1863 near Snodgrass Hill on the Tennessee-Georgia border, was one of the bloodiest battles of the American Civil War, second only to the Battle of Gettysburg in regards to the number of casualties. Indeed, it is said that so much blood was spilled on the battlefield that a creature of great malice was drawn to the devastation. A beast with green, glowing eyes is claimed to have haunted the land long before the arrival of the Civil War. After the Battle of Chickamauga, some reported seeing such a creature moving among the corpses near Snodgrass Hill. Such reports allegedly described the monster as being human-like, with eerie green eyes and a huge, deformed jaw from which terrifying fangs protruded. In the centuries after the Civil War, visitors and rangers at the Chickamauga National Park have reported encounters with the same green-eyed creature. Some say that the entity is a ghost of a long-dead warrior. Others say that it is something else, something inhuman. Whatever the truth of the matter, the creature is known by those who report encountering it simply as Old Green Eyes. In the 1970s, two different and unrelated people had accidents near the same location in the park, having driven their cars off the road, wrecking them after seeing a pair of glowing eyes. However, one of the most notable encounters involved Edward Tinney, a park ranger. Speaking during an interview in 1981, he explained how he was walking through the park at around 4 a.m. sometime in 1976 when an inexplicable chill rushed over his body. The very next moment, he watched as a green-eyed being stepped out of the darkness. In his own words, "When it passed me, I could see his hair was long like a woman's. The eyes, I'll never forget those eyes. They were glaring, almost greenish-orange in color, flashing like some sort of wild animal. The teeth were long and pointed like fangs. I didn't know whether to run or scream or what. Then the headlights of an approaching car came blazing through the fog, and the thing disappeared right in front of me." Unfortunately, like so many sightings of unknown creatures in wartime, the original accounts of old Green Eyes have become obscure and largely forgotten, lost to the tides of time. Of all the sightings of mysterious creatures in wartime, none is more widely reported than the rock apes of Vietnam. Throughout the Vietnam War, fighters on both sides of the conflict regularly encountered large bipedal apes in the dense jungles. Bizarrely, Vietnam is home to no such wild apes. Even before conflict found its way to the jungles of Vietnam, there had been a long local tradition of strange creatures lurking in the wilderness. Various names had been assigned to the creatures by local peoples, including Batatut, Ujit, or Forest People. Particularly cited within the Vu Quang Nature Reserve, such stories describe muscular, bipedal beings with ape-like features around 6 feet tall, covered in reddish-brown hair, excepting the knees, soles of the feet, hands, and face. A commonly reported trait on the Forest People is their displays of boldness and, on occasion, aggression. In Borneo, where the creatures are also claimed to exist, witnesses state that they do occasionally kill humans. Whilst the locals of these regions consider the creatures to be a fact of life, the Batatut was relatively unknown to the outside world. That was until war pushed its way into the creature's supposed habitat. Among American soldiers, the creatures were known as rock apes, supposedly because of their propensity to hurl rocks at soldiers. In the decades after the Vietnam War, veteran testimonies of encounters with these creatures are commonplace. One such veteran who served as an airborne infantry squad leader with the 101st Airborne in 1968 to 1969 described seeing numerous brown and reddish-brown rock apes around the Ashaw Valley. Although sightings of the creatures were common, they were likely never killed. As silence was the rule of the jungle, unnecessary gunfire was to be avoided at all costs. According to the eyewitness, the higher echelons of command wanted confirmed body counts and not mysterious creature sightings. As such, many rock ape sightings were unreported at the time. Another testimony comes from Michael Kelly, who served from 1969 to 1970. In the year 2000, he described how 8 rock apes surprised a squadron of his platoon, resulting in open fire being launched at the creatures. At first believing the mysterious apes to be the enemy, being the correct height, they looked very much like soldiers in khaki, the firing had been nonstop as the creatures hurled themselves through the trees. In Kelly's own words, "All except one was light brown to reddish brown in color and about 3.5 to 4 feet tall. One dark, almost black male remained fighting to protect the other's retreat as he was flying through the branches and rushing the men with his teeth bared." Despite the large amount of gunfire, when Kelly searched the site, he could not find a single drop of blood. With such a multitude of spectacular reports, one cannot help but wonder just what the rock apes were and if they are still around today. Over the years, a wide variety of unconvincing theories have been proposed. From the widespread use of highly hallucinogenic drugs like LSD by soldiers, to mass confusion of mysterious 6-foot-tall bipedal so-called rock apes with Vietnam's largest native primate species, the critically endangered 3-foot-long Tonkin snub-nosed monkey. It seems that, for now at least, the answer to this mystery will remain hidden deep within the dense jungles of Vietnam. In the Pacific Theater of World War II, troops reported witnessing peculiar flying humanoids. Described as possessing a pair of large, leathery wings like a bat, these creatures were said to have been spotted close to military installations on numerous occasions. Silent and shy as they were reported to be, military eyewitnesses could not escape the unnerving feeling that these unearthly beings were somehow observing them. Many of the alleged sightings date to around the time of the Battle of Okinawa in 1945. Years afterwards, reports of flying humanoids in the Pacific were still being made by soldiers. One such report came from Sinclair Taylor, a U.S. Air Force private who was on guard duty at Camp Okubo near Kyoto, Japan in 1952. The sound of the creature's wings first drew the private's attention. To begin with, he thought he was looking at a giant bird. However, as it flew closer, it became clear that it wasn't. According to Taylor's testimony, the enigmatic being had the body of a man about 7 feet tall. It also had a 7-foot wingspan. After having flown closer to the private, the creature stopped and hovered in the air. Panicked, Taylor began firing his weapon at the flying creature. When he looked back at the spot where the winged beast had been, it had vanished. No blood, cadaver, or any other physical evidence was left behind. Even more bizarre is the fact that Taylor was not the only witness to this creature. It has been reported that when he declared the incident to his sergeant, it was revealed that another guard had witnessed the exact same creature the year before. Although Private Sinclair Taylor had no knowledge of the previous sighting and had no contact with the other eyewitness, the two descriptions of the winged creatures were astonishingly similar. Theories as to what Taylor and others saw include secret military projects and the misidentification of local wildlife. Misidentification suggestions include crows, which are reported to be much larger in Japan than in other parts of the world. Certainly, in some countryside areas, crows with a wingspan twice the size of the typical carrion crow are described by rural farmers. These super-sized birds are also reported to be more reserved and less vocal than the common crow, which fits with descriptions of alleged flying humanoids. This being said, misidentification of crows or other large birds does not account for the alleged human characteristics of these creatures, nor does it explain their seemingly unnatural ability to survive rapid gunfire, as reported by Sinclair Taylor. As such, the true nature of the flying humanoid creatures of Japan remains a mystery. When Weird Darkness returns, you've heard of the gunfight at the OK Corral, but that was men versus men. To get really exciting, you need true stories of gunfights between men and extraterrestrials. And on Ocracoke Island, there is a small channel of water known as Teach's Hole, named after Edward Teach, and where it is said Edward met his end, and his ghost still lingers there. And if Edward Teach doesn't sound familiar to you, it could be that you know him better as Blackbeard. These stories are up next. If you've been with me for the full run of 4.5 years doing this podcast, you know that twice a year, June and December, I take 1 week to concentrate on saving the lives of families in Haiti and Guatemala and other areas of the Caribbean and Latin America through an organization called Food for the Poor. I'm not paid to raise funds for them. I do it because I believe in what they do and how they do it. I give to them monthly all year long anyway because I believe in what they do. In the past, the story has been pretty much the same. Families starving with practically nothing to eat, waiting in line for hours to get enough food to barely survive. Food for the Poor has been essential in saving these lives by providing food and clean water in the poorest areas of the planet. You'd think it couldn't get any worse for these people. But then COVID-19 struck. Yes, coronavirus itself struck these people down, but that wasn't the worst of it. It also devastated those who were trying to help them and those who were financially helping. Suddenly now the number of volunteers has dwindled because there were so many in quarantine or who are sick themselves from the virus. The donations have shriveled up because businesses and individuals who have been generous up to now have had a sudden halt on their income. Haiti and Guatemala are at emergency levels now. As you could probably guess, there is no government stimulus package or safety nets for these people. The threat of starvation and famine was already real. But now it's imminent. And even the very, very few people who were working before to eke out a meager life, they're now forced to remain at home due to the quarantine. And they don't have work-from-home jobs like some of us do. They are forced to stay at home with no food for their children and no hope to earn money in order to buy food. Unemployment has skyrocketed, worse than for those of us in the modern world. Those who worked as street vendors or day laborers, which really were the only jobs most of them could find anyway, have no income whatsoever now. Most children received only one meal per day, and that meal was provided by the school they attended. Well, now those schools have also been forced to close due to the pandemic. So those children now have zero meals per day. While many parts of the modern world are slowly beginning to see a light at the end of this COVID-19 tunnel, Haiti and Guatemala, who were already worse off before the pandemic than we ever were during it, are now in a crisis situation tenfold. They're now in a situation where entire villages could completely disappear from existence due to starvation. Now, the reason I'm bringing this up before June is hopefully pretty obvious. We can't afford to wait until then. The need is too dire. They've asked if we could please start early. So I'm asking you, my weirdo family, to join me now in this. I know I lost half my income recently. I told you about it before, but I still have a full pantry and a full fridge. Somehow, by the grace of God, my bills are still being paid, so I upped my monthly giving to Food for the Poor. Now, I'm not asking you to do that, unless, of course, you feel led to do so, in which case, great, but all I'm asking is that you consider making a simple, one-time, tax-deductible donation of just $37. That's it. One time. A one-time donation of $37. That'll feed a child in Haiti or Guatemala for a full 6 months. I know, it sounds like science fiction, but it's reality. Thanks to the way Food for the Poor works, they buy food in bulk. They use local organizations to distribute the food. They use local volunteers in those areas to help, etc. $37 feeds a child for a full 6 months. If you can give a one-time gift of $74, you feed two children for 6 months. You can do the math from there. Maybe you can do a monthly gift of just $7. That's just $2 more than being a patron of Weird Darkness. It doesn't sound like much, but it adds up to more than $74, meaning you'd be feeding two children for 6 full months, or one child for a full year. If you were planning on being a Weird Darkness patron, maybe do this instead. Whatever you can give, however you want to do it, to make your donation, click the red emergency food relief banner at WeirdDarkness.com. You can give online right now. It only takes a moment. Or if you'd rather donate by phone, the number is 855-901-4673. That's 855-901-4673. The important thing is that you do it as soon as possible. The need is great. The situation is dire. By the way, this does not affect the Weird Darkness store. All profits I make in the store during the month of May 2020 are still going to the International Foundation for Research and Education of Depression. That doesn't change. This is just an emergency that popped up that I didn't think could wait. So again, call 855-901-4673 to make your donation. 855-901-4673 or click the Emergency Food Relief banner at WeirdDarkness.com. One of the most controversial of all of Bob Lazar's claims, made after he allegedly briefly worked in late 1988 at a portion of Area 51 called S4, is that he read a series of highly classified documents on various aspects of the UFO phenomenon. One of those documents, Lazar maintained, told a strange and sinister story of a violent confrontation between security personnel at Area 51 and a group of aliens that were in residence and working at S4 alongside a scientific team. It was a confrontation that reportedly resulted in more than a few deaths, far more than a few. Lazar had admitted that he cannot say for sure that the briefing papers he read were the real thing. He has acknowledged that they may have been nothing but disinformation designed to swamp him with both real and bogus material. Why might the project leaders at Area 51 do such a thing? Simple. If there were concerns that Lazar might blow the whistle on what he knew, which, as history has shown, he did in 1989, mixing up the truth with a more than liberal amount of lies might have an adverse effect on his credibility. It should be noted that's exactly what happened. That said, although he cannot say for sure that the documentation was the real deal, he does recall the contents of the material in relation to this firefight situation. According to Lazar, the deadly confrontation occurred at some point in 1979 in the S4 facility. Lazar said, "I believe the altercation came about in 1979 or sometime like that, and I don't remember exactly how it was started, but it had something to do with the security personnel. The aliens were in a separate room. I think it had something to do with the bullets the security guards were carrying, and somehow they were trying to be told that they couldn't enter the area with the bullets, possibly because it was hazardous. The bullets could explode through some field or whatever." Lazar continued that despite the warning, one of the security guards did indeed enter the room with the bullets, something which resulted in a violent and lethal response from the aliens. Lazar recalled that the papers he read described how the security personnel were all quickly killed by head wounds. The same fate befell a group of scientists on the program too. Timothy Good, who interviewed Lazar at the height of the controversy surrounding his claims, said, "The incident is said to have led to the termination of an alien liaison at the Nevada test site." It's important to note here that there is a variation to this story. Not from Lazar, who stuck to his story, which he read out at S4, but from a man named Paul Benowitz, who in the late 1970s began digging into claims that an alien base did exist below the New Mexico town of Dulce. From intelligence personnel at Kirtland Air Force Base, Albuquerque, Benowitz learned of a story of a fatal encounter between hostile aliens and a security team in the lower levels of the Dulce base. The different location given to Benowitz is just about the only difference between what Lazar was told and what Benowitz was told. Clearly, both scenarios cannot be true, something which means we must give deep consideration to the possibility that the papers Lazar read were not the real deal. They may well have been disinformation. So might have been the data provided to Paul Benowitz. In other words, there is a strong likelihood that both tales were fabricated and fed to Lazar and Benowitz as a means to confuse the truth surrounding what is really going on at Area 51, and which may actually have nothing to do with real aliens, hostile or not. On Ocracoke Island is a small channel of water known as Teach's Hole. This inlet is reported to be the spot where the pirate Edward Teach, better known as Blackbeard, preferred to anchor his ship. It is also said to be where he met his end, and some say his ghost haunts the spot to this day. Blackbeard roamed the Atlantic from around 1716 until 1718, robbing ships from the West Indies to the Carolinas. He had a reputation for unbridled ferocity. When Blackbeard went into battle, he strapped multiple pistols and multiple cutlasses to his body. Most frightening of all, he wove fuses into his long black beard and set them on fire just before he stepped onto the captured ship. This towering figure, armed to the teeth, sporting a sparking, flaming beard, must have been absolutely terrifying. Ship's captains would surrender without a shot being fired. Blackbeard's reign on the high seas came to an end November 22, 1718. Virginia Governor Alexander Spotswood sent a ship commanded by John Maynard down to the North Carolina coast to track down and kill Blackbeard. Maynard surprised Blackbeard and a skeleton crew anchored at Teach's Hole. In the ferocious battle that followed, Blackbeard was shot 5 times and stabbed no less than 20. The pirate crew was all killed or captured. Blackbeard's head was chopped off and hung from the bowsprit of Maynard's ship. The pirate's headless body was thrown overboard. Legend has it that the headless body swam around Maynard's ship 3 times before sinking below the waters. Ever since then, it has been said that Blackbeard's ghost haunts the spot known as Teach's Hole. Many people have reported seeing a strange light moving beneath the water in the cove. This ghostly light is thought by some to be Blackbeard's spirit, swimming through the waters, searching for his missing head. There are those who believe that on stormy nights you can hear Blackbeard's voice calling out in the wind. On nights when the angry wind is roaring and the hard rain is coming down, many people have heard a horrible roaring coming from this hidden cove. They say that it is an unearthly noise that sounds like a pained human voice bellowing, "Where's my head?" While his reign of terror on the seas was short, Blackbeard's legacy lives on in the legends of North Carolina. We're also learning even more about this frightening pirate every day, ever since the discovery of the wreck of the Queen Anne's Revenge. Archaeologists and historians have been working on recovering and restoring artifacts from this sunken ship captained by the notorious pirate, and we're discovering fascinating details of what life was like on an 18th-century pirate ship. While Blackbeard's viciousness has gone down in history, these stories may be a fact of history being written by the winners. Except for the final battle, there's no record of Blackbeard ever having killed anyone. The show, with the massive arsenal and flaming beard, may have been deliberately designed to avoid a fight. Blackbeard seems to have understood that having a reputation for being a bloodthirsty murderer could save you the trouble of actually being a bloodthirsty murderer. And while pirates are considered to be bad guys of history, it's hard not to sympathize with the pirates over the British Navy. Pirate crews were better treated and better paid than Navy crews. Furthermore, pirate crews were on their ships by choice, as opposed to the Navy crews, many of whose members would have been pressed into service. Pirate ships were also essentially democratic institutions. The pirate captain would be elected by the crew and generally selected on the basis of competence and fairness as a leader. The captain's decisions on where and when to sail would be put to a vote, and his authority became absolute only during battle. This was a stark contrast to the British Navy at the time, where the captaincy of a ship was based more on being born to the right family than on any ability to competently lead a crew. It's also important to remember what the pirates were stealing and from whom. A large portion of the vessels passing through the Atlantic at this time were holding enslaved human beings as cargo. When intercepting a slave ship, pirate crews would routinely free those otherwise destined for a life of unimaginable misery. These men would be offered the opportunity to join the ship's crew, with chances of their being able to return home being tragically small. It was an offer many of them took up. Records show that as much as half of any given pirate ship's crew in the early 18th century would have been composed of freed Africans. Even Blackbeard's trusted second-in-command, who died fighting with him at Teach's Hole, was one of these men, known to us only as Black Caesar. While many pirates did kill and plunder, they were killing and plundering from people who were themselves killing, plundering, enslaving, and exploiting lands which had been invaded and were held by force. What seemed to offend the authorities so much about the pirates was not their tactics, but that somebody else was getting a cut of the action. Thanks for listening to this episode of Weird Darkness. If you like what you heard, please help the podcast grow and recommend the podcast to your friends and family. I'd also greatly appreciate a 5-star rating in the podcast app that you're using with a few nice words about the podcast. It helps to get the podcast noticed by others. Do you have a dark tale to tell of your own? Click on Tell Your Story at WeirdDarkness.com, and I might use it in a future episode. Also on the website, you can find the Weirdos Facebook group, paranormal and horror audiobooks that I've narrated, the Weird Darkness store, my contact info and social media links, the events calendar. Plus, you can visit the Hope in the Darkness page if you're struggling with depression, anxiety, or thoughts of suicide. And if you listen to the podcast at your place of employment, be sure to check out the Weird at Work page. Every month, I randomly choose from the entries one business to give a shout-out to, and I also send them a Weird Darkness Weird at Work prize pack. This has been a Dark Archives episode of Weird Darkness. You can find links to the stories or the authors featured in this episode in the show notes. Weird Darkness is a registered trademark of Marler House Productions. Copyright Marler House Productions 2020. I'm Darren Marler. Thanks for joining me in the Weird Darkness. And until next time, John 12:46.